So we were talking last night about, you know, thinking big.
Yeah.
And then when we think we thought big enough, we realized we could think even bigger. And if we talk about infinite loop,
yeah,
it's like, how big could you actually imagine? And I don't think we can. And this brought me to a conversation I had where we're talking about small ball versus big ball.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, how do you know that you are stuck in a small ball? You put yourself in a small ball world. And there's this big ball that's sitting right on the other side of that wall.
Yeah. So I think a few things come to mind when we talk about playing too small. And one is understanding infinite is so big. It's beyond what you can imagine. I had someone ask me one time about my God, and I talk about your God, but my God, I explained it as infinitely abundant, unified in a system of thought. Omniscient, all powerful, all knowing, loves me, protects me, promotes me more than my mom. And the person who asked me said, and you know that your God that you just explained in the infinite realm has a God even bigger than that. That's the whole idea of infinite, right? So I think when we're thinking about playing small ball, for me, I get very pragmatic and I understand that at all times I'm limiting myself. And the number one limitation, whether it's business, personal, relationship, whatever it may be, is actually something I have complete control over, which is meaning. You see, most people limit their self-image, their imagination, by the meaning they give their past. The failures, the mistakes, the setbacks, defining moments, historical relevances, successes. We're constantly giving meaning to what has already happened. And that is truly what limits us. So whether we're always playing small ball will be determined by that limitation. It also is why we'll feel stuck, because we're trying to grow. Just always remember, when you feel stuck, this is a good thing. Because if you were in a room and you weren't trying to get out of that room and you weren't growing, you wouldn't know you were stuck. Right? If you were in that room and all you were doing is doom scrolling all day, and I locked all the doors, you and someone came up, hey, how you doing? Do you feel stuck? No, man, this is great. You're not trying to get out. But if you were just trying to get out, you had to take a pee, and I locked all the doors, you'd feel very stuck. Because you're trying to get out. You're trying to grow. And so I tell myself all the time, this is a good thing. You know, grass grows real easy until it reaches what? The surface, and then it has to break through. Most people quit because they like it's warm and wet and soft, but keep pushing, keep doubling down. Learning lessons is how you get unstuck. There's only one way to get unstuck: learn lessons. Every problem, solution's already there. Lapse of time between the problem and the solution, just a lapse of time. I always say that's why they call it a resolution. It's a resolution because it was already there. They just would have called it a solution, not a resolution. It is the resolution to your every pain problem. Also remember, in feeling stuck, we feel pain. People misinterpret pain. They want to get rid of pain. You can't get rid of pain. See, pain is just a communicator. It's communicating with you. So your back is sore. Pain is telling you, hey, there's a problem with your back. Same thing in business, same thing emotionally. It is just telling you, it's indicating, it's communicating with you. So if you can shift your own perspective that this feeling stuff, this pain is communicating that there's a trauma, there's a problem, there's something that needs to be fixed. And the only way to fix it is what? To find lessons, to get a resolution. And it is those lessons that allow us to have ease instead of dis-ease. I categorize everything. Is this easy or dis-easy? Is this aligned with where I want to be, or is it interfering with what I be? I keep things simple. I'm not that intelligent. So it becomes real easy. Like, I meet people now, and when certain people walk up, I'm like, oh, she puts me at ease, right? I just feel better. So that's someone that I want to be closer to and learn from and be with and help. And then other people, they give me the ick, right? And they make me feel shitty about myself. And I'm like, you know what? That person's dis-ease. That event is dis-ease. That circumstance is dis-ease. So when it's dis-ease, I what? Either have to find the light, the love, and the lesson, or take myself out of the dis-ease.
Awesome.
Great first question. Yes.
I got it.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Hey, right. David, thank you, first of all, for your great work. Thank you for being so awesome and, I guess, dedicated to what you do. The question is related to non-for-profits. How has that changed your strategies and how do you implement it? We find ourselves now with a development company, as you know. We have a community aspect of it that we want to create a non-for-profit. Can you speak to, like, how can we utilize that, or what aspects of that should we be considering to integrate it into one bigger picture?
Yeah. So there's a variety of ways that we can give back, especially in the premise of a not-for-profit, a nonprofit, a charitable organization. I start everything with timing and risk tolerance. So all tithing, all giving to me is predetermined, unemotional. So for me, there's a percentage of everything that I make will go to give back. And it's not a number. It's just I'm dedicated or devotional. And, you know, I'll use the common one, which is 10% of everything gross. Everything that comes to me, I'm going to give back. And that can be divided into a different organization. So for me, Napoleon Hill Institute, I'm chancellor of Junior Achievement and then Unstoppable Foundation. I don't give equitably of my money to those three because Unstoppable for Women needs the most. Napoleon Hill is very large in the Junior Achievement, like the seventh largest charity in the world. You know, an extra $100,000 means nothing. I'm sure it'll mean something, but compared to Unstoppable, it moves the needle. And so I give my time to all three, but it's all based off of timing and risk tolerance. And then you mentioned community. So for me, the number one aspect of a nonprofit is to build a community of people that want to help each other and know people that help each other. And so that can be built at all times in coordination with your purpose-driven company, which you obviously have a purpose-driven company beyond a nonprofit. The impact that you do in sustainable housing has a huge impact. But I would just use math, and I love to take emotion out of everything and just use math. And predetermination, utilizing timing and risk tolerance, to me, makes my life so easy. So my giving's easy, my kids, everything's just proportionate. Does it stop me from wanting to make more money? No, because that 10%, if I make $100 million, becomes way more than if I made $1 million. But I'm not gonna give more than that 10%.
Thanks.
Yeah.
You're awesome.
Great. You're awesome. Thank you. Good to see you again. All right.
Good to see you again. Probably been a couple of years.
Right? Yeah.
My question,
so much fun, right? A couple of years go by.
Exactly. my question would be about a moment, meaning a moment when for you, let's say a decision, a business decision, a new endeavor. What drives you to make a decision at that point? Is, you know, do you rely on your gut? Let's say it's one of those things where the numbers may not really align, but you feel like, hey, this is it. What would drive a decision in that?
Yeah. So really good point. So for me, decisions are prioritized. And so there's several levels of decision-making. One's intelligence, which is the math of it and the vetting of that math. Then there's intuition. One of the biggest mistakes people make about intuition is that it doesn't work in man-made time. So I'll give you an example that's true to me where I really learned this. And so you get these gut feelings and they're only meant for God to tell you, hey, you need to be aware of this, not to take action immediately. It's an awareness. So I tell the same thing when I'm teaching. If something resonates with you, you feel strongly about it, capture it. And I say strongly, I mean positively or negatively. I learn more from when somebody says something and I have a knee-jerk reaction, an intuitive reaction of like, that's the dumbest motherfucking thing I've ever heard. This pisses me off. That person's an idiot. I'm writing that down. I'm like, why was that so visceral? Did that move you so much? You're supposed to learn something from that. As much as like my favorite quote, you know, you're either humble or you're about to be. When I heard that, it drops me to my knees almost every time. It's like a constant reminder of all the incorporation of wisdom and faith that one statement to me incorporates wisdom and faith. You're either humble or you're about to be. So when you're thinking about making a decision, I start with intelligence first, and then I'm paying attention to my intuition as an awareness to do more vetting. So if I'm at a craps table, and God's talked to me when I'm at a craps table, when I used to play craps, God would say heart eight. And I'd take $1,000 immediately and put it on the heart eight, and no heart eight. And then I'd be like, wait a second, God doesn't lie, right? So I put another 1,000. Then eventually I don't. And then three more rolls later, heart eight comes up. Because God doesn't know man-made constructive time. He can't put it into 24 hours. He's just saying, hey, dummy, I got a lesson for you. And I got the lesson, $5,000 worth of lesson. That intuition has no time. But I elevate my awareness now to pay attention. Pay attention to this. At some time, this will be part of the decision-making process. I think the bigger part is the vetting. Yeah. You know, if you're a faithful person, a trustworthy person, I used to trust people and trust my intuition without vetting it. Vetting means doing my due diligence, asking uncomfortable questions of others and myself, and not feeling bad about it. I actually turned it in my head, kind of like giving and receiving. I believe that when I receive, I'm giving you a bigger gift than I'm receiving, because I'm making you able and capable of helping me, which is closest to God. But for me, on the same respect, it shifts that paradigm. I'm feeling like you're getting as much as I'm getting out of this. When I vet you, I'm trusting you more. And I'll use the people I trust the most. Like my mom, super honest person, never would intentionally, if she ever lied to me, it was because she thought it was to my benefit. So she used to say, oh, you're so beautiful, you're so handsome and so smart. And she just would lie to me and make me feel better for my benefit. But that's okay. But when I vet you, I'm saying, I'm trusting what you said. I need complete clarification. I'm not, our relationship is so trustworthy that I know it won't offend you that I'm asking to talk to a reference or to see your W-2 or whatever else you represented to me. Because I trust you, not because I don't trust you. Because I've saved myself now so much by asking uncomfortable questions of people that have had good intentions. Because what happened in the past is you'd say something that I either misunderstood or it just didn't seem right. But yet I trusted you, so I didn't say anything. And then later on, the truth would come out and then I'd blame you because I didn't ask the uncomfortable question. And a lot of times it's unintentional lying. We either misunderstood, misinterpret, or someone's excited and they oversell you, back end sell you, manipulate the facts a little bit. You know, they'll say something like, you know, my revenue's up 3 times this year, but they forgot to tell you the revenue was $9 last year and you assumed it was 9 million, but you never asked me. Yeah. So vetting's a big part of intuition.
Got it.
Awesome. Thank you.
It's still the best day of my life.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It was so good. All right, who's next?
Question.
They're free. All right.
Let me put this down.
Okay. Chess King. Teaches hundreds of thousands of kids to play chess.
I tell people that I'm still learning. I tell my students I'm in pre-K. I only know a teeny little bit. And the reason being is once you know it all, you're no longer teachable. So I'm always at zero. I'm never going to get to one because it's always something to learn. But my thing is, who is your mentors? Who do you learn from? I you know, you mentioned Bob Proctor yesterday.
Yeah.
I played him a game of chess. I beat him in 2 moves. Les Brown, I beat him in a few moves. Jack Canfield almost beat me and wrote the foil for my book. But who is your big mentors? I'm big on Earl Nightingale, the Jim Rohn.
Yeah. Those are the OGs. Wayne Dyer for sure. You know, first of all, I have mentors by subject matter, topic, and expertise. So, for example, if I wanted to learn chess, you'd be my mentor. And I'd play for a team of chess. So I'd ask you, who could I help as well as you help me? So I'm always looking to see, according to subject matter, topic, or expertise, who's the person that sits in the situation that I want to be in? And who's on the team that I can help as well? Because I know the fastest way to get to where I want to be by subject matter, topic, and expertise is to find someone that's already there, ask them for direction, but also help someone get to where I am. Both are really important. And so it's really, for me, subjects, you know, in spirituality, A Course in Miracles is a mentor. Bob Proctor, Jack Canfield, Wayne Dyer, they're great intention mentors. Michael Singer, when it comes to surrender, which is, I believe, a big issue that I deal with in coaching people. They just can't understand the conflictual nature of surrendering. Like, hyper-competitive people have a difficult time understanding, especially surrender. They think surrendering is sitting at home high on your mom's couch, sick and broke. Like, I'm not going to give up. And so it's really not surrender, right? It's a reconciliation of the human experience with the infinite, or a detachment of emotion. So shifting a paradigm of, for the sake of what, from I'll be happy when, right? I asked everybody, so for the sake of what are you doing that? Not I'll be happy when. So my mentors are really varied, determined by subject matter, topic, and expertise. I have a golf mentor, you know, Virgil Herring, who's literally one of the best golf coaches. And then I'm able and capable of helping younger people that I play with a few of the best tips from one of the best coaches. So, but I think life-changing mentors, my mom is my number one mentor in life.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, and Sharon Lecter for money. thank you.
When you look back on your career as an entrepreneur, do you also look at that as really a spiritual journey, an opportunity for everybody?
Yeah. So when I look back, on the entrepreneurial journey, do I also see it as a spiritual journey? Right. Everything to me is a spiritual journey. You know, once I understood that I am, what am I doing to interfere with it? So there's always spirituality, because there's always inspiration, being in spirit and being at ease. So this simple categorization of activities in my day, whether it's non-negotiable or negotiable, but then again, is it aligned with my divine direction or interfering with it? So it's people, places, things, circumstances, events. In my head, I'm quickly assessing, is this person aligned with my divine direction or interfering with it? Is this idea that I'm having, is this TV show I'm watching, is it aligned with my divine direction or is it interfering with it? And it started with like some real obvious ones that most people struggle with. I chewed tobacco, right? Is chewing tobacco aligned with my divine direction or was it interfering with me? Alcohol, was it aligned with my divine direction? Cocaine, aligned with my, I went down and I see all these people that I mentor going, hey man, let's start with the basics. You know, what you eat, what you drink, what you think, is it aligned? And pretty soon you get really good at shortening the distance of resistance that you create for yourself. And that resistance, and I'll repeat that, I'm constantly shortening the distance of resistance by figuring out, and it's all spiritual. The only thing that's man-made in its constructs to me that quantifiably should be measured is time and money. I'm constantly quantifying time and money, knowing that they're not spiritual. They're man-made constructs. And so, you know, I talked about this last night. People are confused. You cannot give a man-made construct and get back the same construct. You can, more happiness you give, the more you receive. More love, more forgiveness, more kindness you give, the more you receive. But the more money you give, the more money you will not receive. It'd be the same as me saying, the more cameras I give, the more cameras I'm going to receive. That's as stupid as it is. But the more value you give, the more value you receive, but it doesn't come in formation of the same information. Same thing with time. Time's a limited construct by man, the 24 hours of time, not the infinite time. So if you give 5 hours of time, you're not going to receive it back. So to understand how spirituality is intertwined with the two key man-made constructs that will make a difference in the human experience. The two things in the human experience that are man-made that will make a big difference to reconcile with your spirituality is money and time. Money and time will change your human experience if you give it the right meaning. I used to joke around and say, you know, money will not buy you love or happiness, but it allows you to shop. And if you shop for the right things, it will bring you love and happiness. If you shop for the right things. It's the same that I could tell you, time will not bring you love or happiness, but if you use it in the divine direction, it will. And that's the difference between, I keep saying divine direction. I'm very disciplined. I was born disciplined. And I learned there's a big difference between discipline and devotion. Because I meet tons of people that are disciplined at working and they don't make any money. They're so disciplined in working, they don't spend time on their health. They're so disciplined in working, they don't spend time with their families. But if you ask them, why are you disciplined in working? They'll tell you, so I can live longer, have time with my family, and make more money. But devotion's different, right? Now I'm categorizing my discipline in a divine direction, which makes it devotional. It also gives me a greater resilience to when evidence isn't there or the evidence is contrary to where I want to be. When everybody else is telling you it's not going to work, when you're mortgaging your house to pay for shit and moving, that's devotion. That's in a divine direction, and it's beyond discipline because it has meaning aligned with where you want to be or better.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Awesome.